Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
You are Locked On Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I am Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to bring you your team every day. Today was Warriors-Cavs 2, the second and final game between the Warriors and Cavs this regular season. Warriors won it going away, 126-91. Dominant win, huge first half, lots of different things to go over, and the perfect guest to do so with. Adam Wharton, who runs the Fast Break blog for the San Jose Mercury News, frequent Locked On Warriors guest, especially for big games, because he can tap into the X's and O's, but also the emotionality and the resonance of a game like this. That's why I lean on him in moments like this, and really enjoyed the conversation. Runs about 35 minutes. I hope you enjoy it too. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Altogether different circumstances than the last time we did one of these after a Cavs-Warriors game. The Warriors really did dominate this game, and there are a couple different reasons why, but just to go through the basics, they won 126-91. Strong performances from just about everybody. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head of the players, you know, in the key parts of the rotation who had a particularly bad game.
Yeah, this was the performance I think we had all sort of expected to see on Christmas Day. This looked like the Warriors seeking revenge, going out to send a message to the Cavs, to LeBron. They were dominant from start to finish, with the exception of a little bit of a hiccup in the third quarter. So it was a big step forward. I think against an elite team, this is the type of performance that we should expect and that we want to see from this team.
I do want to note that, and this is just my read, you know, of being in the building and all that, that I didn't think that the Cavs brought their A intensity. Whether they brought their A game is a little bit different, and that takes a little bit of the edge off this, but it was still a strong performance by the Warriors. It's just, you know, that's just something to consider.
Yeah, I don't think that the Warriors are 30 or 40 points better than the Cavs. I think that's extreme. And definitely with the Cavs at the end of a trip, you know, missing J.R. Smith, I think, is an underrated aspect. Against the Warriors, he is a wild card. When he hits his shots and plays well, it seems to really get them going. So there were a couple different factors, but the thing that impressed me is that we saw Curry being assertive. We saw him really sort of put his stamp on the game. And Draymond had sort of a run-in with LeBron, but it wasn't a crippling run-in. It was something that he used for motivation, and I think he handled it pretty well, all things considered, and ended up just delivering a monster game that was decisive for the Warriors.
I think we should start with Curry. Particularly early, he was assertive, and that was an overwhelming positive. He had 7 shot attempts in the first quarter, ended the game with 20, and also combine that. So at the end of the first half, he was 5 of 11 with 14 points, but also had 10 assists and 0 turnovers. So almost a picture-perfect game from him.
Yeah, you couldn't have asked for a better first half from Curry. I'm impressed that Kerr let him run the full first quarter. I think that that's a nice move because it really establishes him with every sort of lineup and permutation of the team that's going out there. It puts the ball in his hands, and it tells him you're going to be driving this team from the get-go. And Curry, I think, exercised great judgment. He was aggressive in going to the basket, I think, on the first possession of the game. He was pulling up for the three off of the offense, sort of catching and shooting, looking like the Curry that we saw last year, being willing to take those shots, making them. And even when he missed them, I think it was good because it really forced the Cleveland defense to extend, put them in a situation where he could move the ball, find space for others, and really got the offense clicking. It's the type of aggressiveness they need from him against these better teams.
I understand the plight that he has of being such a talented offensive player as a scorer who is also the point guard, nominally and functionally. And so what that means is you're trying to keep everybody going, keep everybody at their best, but also you are in many ways the best offensive weapon as a scorer on your own team. And he has been reluctant to call his own number a lot of the time. He actually talked about this a little bit. I can't remember who asked him, might have even been Nate Duncan, about why he was shooting fewer pull-up threes this year. And his answer, while not definitive, was illuminating in the sense of we have so many other things that I think he feels a little bit self-conscious about it. But in this game, he just let it rip, and he was mad after the game. I cracked up because he noted there were a couple of shots that he thought he usually makes and was frustrated that didn't go in, but that's a small thing compared to all the other stuff he was doing out there.
Yeah, the open shots that he misses, I'm more than happy for him to keep shooting those even if they don't go down because they're good for the offense. But I think you really put your finger on the dynamic between Curry and Durant primarily now at this point in terms of how they adjust to one another. It's not a selfishness issue. It's a selflessness issue. The question for Curry is, when am I passing too much? When am I deferring too much to my teammates? And I think we've seen him pull back from deferring a little bit in the last 2 or 3 weeks. The Cleveland game on Christmas could have sent that message, but it seems like the Memphis game was really a turning point for that. And by being more assertive, the offense has just looked more like we've expected from the Warriors, more high-powered, more aggressive, more free-flowing. It's a team that really needs to be attacking, and part of that attack is the idea that Curry can pull up from anywhere at any point in time on the court and just stick daggers in you from 3 points. So it's great to see him getting back to that from the Warriors' perspective.
Part of the reason that I was so obsessed might be a little bit strong, but so intrigued by the idea of Durant on the Warriors is that he is a very different kind of star scorer than almost every other scorer that exists in the league. There are a multitude of great ones. Curry is different in a similar way in that they both are okay with when other people are doing well and are being efficient and they can play off ball. So I always thought that it was going to work, and it's not all the way done. They're not even close to where this will be this year and presumably next year moving forward. But I've been intrigued by the idea that Durant talked about a little bit tonight, and I think some of it is also a little bit of puffing because he likes to be thought about this way. But Durant started with the idea that, you know, he's defense first and that the offense will come to him. And while that's overstating it a bit, tonight was a great illustration of if he wants to really take that to heart, there is a real value to it for the Warriors.
Oh, yeah, it's huge for the Warriors from a perspective of defending LeBron in a 7-game series. You looked at the finals last year, and one of the problems that the Warriors had is when Draymond was out, when Draymond was tentative, you really only had Iguodala to put on LeBron, and you couldn't do that for an extended portion of the game by the end of the series. So now you have this long defender, this quick defender in Durant, who maybe he's not going to bang against LeBron for 30 minutes a night, but if you switch him on to him for 12 or 15 minutes a night, it's a different look. It's a defensive challenge that LeBron has to adapt to that makes the game more complicated for him. So just for the depth and diversity of the Warriors' defense, I think Durant is a huge piece, particularly against Cleveland. I think we saw the benefit of that tonight. But to get back to your offensive balancing point, the first and second quarter, you know, this is textbook for how I think the Warriors want it to go. Curry plays the entire first quarter. He's assertive, scores 8 points. And then in the second quarter, coming down the stretch, it's Durant. He's the one who scores 11 points. Curry's finding him in the offense, really dishing, getting him going. So both players have a chance to shine. They both have their dominant stretches. The idea that you're going to have a team that can defend both of those guys consistently, that's going to be a huge challenge. And so when both of them are going, you get results like this where the Warriors run a team out of the building.
Plus, if the Warriors are getting stops, and that ties in with Durant as much as almost anybody but Draymond, they're so good in transition. And that was one of the big differences in this game. They talked about how going for defensive boards was a point of emphasis in this game because especially Tristan Thompson is wonderful at that. It's one of his biggest strengths. It's a reason why he's a starter on an NBA championship team. It requires strong performances from at least two or three guys on the floor at any given time to handle that. And they're getting better at figuring out how to do that when necessary, but still be dangerous in transition.
Yeah, the defensive aggressiveness is something that they need to fine-tune so that they're not fouling too much, but they do have that kind of killer instinct and really get the offense jump-started off of it. One thing that I think was a turning point in this game compared to the Christmas Day game, you had Draymond on Christmas Day picking up 2 fouls early in the game, taking him out, really kind of throwing the Warriors off their rhythm, making them less aggressive. They lost their heartbeat, their sort of defensive intensity there. Today, it was Kyrie who had the two early fouls. And in a sense, Cleveland lost their offensive aggressor, the person who can really put the Warriors on their heels through penetrating, who's had great success shooting against this team. And it put their offense in a funk early. So really the tale of sort of different aggressiveness. The Warriors managed to be aggressive on defense in this game and stay out of foul trouble largely. And Cleveland, on the flip side, found themselves in some foul trouble and was sort of on the defensive on offense and really wasn't able to get much of anything going throughout the first half.
On the tone of aggressiveness, something that was apparent during the game and has been true, you and I have talked about it numerous times, is that after the Draymond-LeBron play, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, the game got tighter from an officiating standpoint. They started calling touch fouls and everything like that, and that benefits the Cavs almost every single time between these two teams because the Warriors are not structured in a way to maximize a tight whistle, whereas Cleveland absolutely is.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although the whistle got so tight at one point, they even called LeBron for a travel. I nearly fell out of my chair when that happened. But it's a good point in that Draymond and even Clay, in some sense, they are physical defenders. They like to sort of have their hands on you. And so it's easy for players like LeBron, a Harden, a Westbrook to really exploit that and get into people and draw those touch fouls. But I don't think there's really any way around it at this point. It's just the way that the Warriors are constructed. And it's much more damaging, I think, to tell Draymond to sort of be a hands-off defender than to just take your chances with the fouls. That's who they are. And they're at their best when they can manage to be aggressive without having those whistles blown.
Agreed on the foul point, but I would disagree that the big element that swings a ref's whistle from, within a game, the starting point is different, just like an umpire strike zone. It depends on that game and that situation. But what tightens up a whistle guaranteed is hostility. And in those circumstances, Draymond can be a real instigator. In the Cleveland series, that happened. Also, when Draymond was not suspended in that game, I think it was game 5 against the Thunder, game 5 or game 6, that yep. game had an insanely tight whistle because of everything that happened. And so, again, you could argue the exact same thing, that preventing those bigger blowups would be helpful, but maybe that's not possible either. If it were possible, I think that would help the Warriors a little bit more significantly when the margins are as tight as they typically are against Cleveland and maybe the Spurs.
Yeah, no doubt. If you had Draymond never exploding, never getting in the refs' faces, never expressing his frustration, in a perfect world, that'd be good. But I think Draymond is the player that he is. He's always going to play with that fire. And at this point, the Warriors need to look at, okay, how do we manage that? And how do we allow Draymond to be Draymond without kind of throwing off the rhythm of the team? One thing I'd like to see Kerr do, and I know that the team's doing it sort of behind the scenes already, is really put some pressure on the league for what's become a vicious double standard here with Draymond. And not just with the sort of LeBron flop, which we can talk about later, but he's under a microscope. He's getting called for sort of flagrant fouls on things that are just, I think, typical contact that a lot of other players get away with. Now, obviously, he has a history, and that's why he's being looked at more closely. But you're still supposed to be adjudicated on the play. Your history's not supposed to become a factor for that. So whether Kerr needs to take a fine or needs to sort of raise the pressure on the league, whether you need people in the front office sort of being more public and talking about the perceived double standard here, there's some things they can do, I think, to make it more of an issue, to potentially condition the refs and the NBA to having less of a whistle in the playoffs when things matter. This is something that Phil Jackson was great at throughout his career. He would always sort of lead with what the issue with the refs was going to be and sort of throw it out there ahead of time to condition it so that they were second-guessing themselves and maybe not making it as much of an issue as they might.
We're two lawyers, former in my case. I don't even know if that's a fair term, but I feel like we should discuss the flagrant foul. I will. I don't know why I want to set the tone myself, but I'm going to do that because it's my show. I guess I can. And I think that two things are true on that play. One is it was a flagrant foul. The rule is defined as it's the result of contact that is excessive, intentional, or unnecessary. And then there's the potential of risking the play, of injuring the other player. This was excessive. I would say that's pretty comfortable to say. You know, even if he was going for a steal, was trying to stop the fast break, those kind of fouls happen all the time. I think they've happened too much. And there was a slight potential for injury, you know, enough that I don't think that's a big issue. However, the second part, and people got all mad at me on Twitter, not Warriors fans, mostly Cleveland fans, that it was also a flop, because I think back to my experience as a soccer player, and in soccer, the best flops are not the ones where the guy acts like he was shot and nothing happened. It's where you exaggerate contact that was legitimate. And that's really what LeBron did here. Is LeBron is a tank of a human being. He was hit with some force, and he acted like he had been just like exploded from the inside. And he was doing that deliberately. I think he was doing that because he knew who hit him, and he knows that he has already seen the ramifications and the success of doing so. I mean, game four of the finals was a bait, in my opinion. I will feel that way till the day I die, no matter what anybody says, and I don't even think anybody would disagree. I think that's what he was getting at and why he stayed down after he went down, which LeBron never does. But, so both those, I think both those things are true.
So I'm a defense lawyer in my professional life mostly, so I'll defend Draymond on this one. I don't think it was a flagrant foul. I think it was a pretty ridiculous call. If anything, I think LeBron should be getting a flopping fine from the league because it was a clear and gratuitous flop that was meant to change the flow of the game and effectively did by logging another foul on Draymond and eventually a technical for the response that followed. On the replay, a few things that stood out for me in just how non-flagrant it was. One, Draymond is leading and hit the way that he intersects with LeBron. He's not going for the body. He's going for the ball. He's in front of LeBron. So if he was just going in for a body shot, he could have gone straight into LeBron's body. He didn't. He goes in front of him. Two, if you watch LeBron, LeBron sees in his peripheral vision that Draymond's coming in from the side. LeBron turns his body into the contact before it happens to exaggerate the contact. So you have LeBron turning his shoulder to sort of go broadside into Draymond to make sure that Draymond makes more contact with him. So if there was any excessive contact on the play, it's from LeBron making a non-basketball move, changing the way that he's contorted his body to draw the contact. Three, Draymond tries to catch LeBron as he's going down. He knows LeBron is going to sort of exaggerate the contact in this situation, and his trailing arm, he's actually trying to catch LeBron if you see him. But LeBron is too busy recoiling in his gunshot motion, like he got hit in the head, to really let Green catch him or break his fall at all. So he just goes straight down in a flop, rolls over, grabs his head, immediately exaggerates everything. And then the post-game comments about how he got hit in the head when he clearly didn't. He didn't know who it was, when I'm sure someone of LeBron's court awareness was perfectly clear on who it was. It's all just gaslighting. It's just trolling. So, you know, LeBron can be petty like this. He can play with the media like this. He can try to get in people's heads like this. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't call it out. A player as good as LeBron has no need to do any of this stuff. He shouldn't have to resort to this flopping and trying to take the cheap way out rather than beat players on the basketball court by following the rules. So I think the call was ridiculous. It was a foul, but it wasn't flagrant. It shouldn't have been a technical. Richard Jefferson continues to interject himself into situations where he really has no time being there. And Draymond, because of his reputation, is not getting fair treatment from the NBA. And I think the Warriors should make a bigger stink out of it now rather than have it blow up later in the playoffs.
I wonder if they'll rescind the technical. I don't think they'll do anything about the flagrant foul, but there's a possibility that they rescind the technical on that just because of the circumstances. There have been a couple Russell Westbrook ones that I don't have the itemized list of which ones of his have been rescinded, but it does seem a little bit similar in that way, where it was reacting to something that was a little bit of overplay and an instigation from the other team.
Yeah, he's getting, you know, James is flopping, Jefferson is getting in his face. The idea that you would hit him with both the flagrant and the technical there just seems pretty out of hand given the circumstances. You know, the way that LeBron went down, if he really was hit in the head, you should have concussion protocols here. If you have somebody who thinks that they took such a hard hit, but everybody in the building knew that it was LeBron flopping, and the fact that the refs sort of watched replays and let him get away with it, I think is, you know, I won't speak about the officiating crew, but, you know, I disagree with the call.
I'll go through for clarity because I pulled it up while we were talking. The definition of a flagrant foul. So really, it's a contact committed against the player with or without the ball that is unnecessary is a flagrant one, and then unnecessary and excessive is a flagrant two. Clearly, to me, not a flagrant two. I respect your argument that it's not a flagrant one. I think it is a judgment call. That's why I tried. If this wasn't clear, I will be clear. It was not an unambiguous situation for me. I think it was certainly a judgment call in that. The idea of unnecessary to me was just a little bit, but you're right that LeBron made it more unnecessary than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, if you're going to strip the ball from someone running up the court and you're coming from the side, there's no other way to approach them to make that basketball play. You don't have the speed to sort of get in front of them, turn around, and play it straight on. So you come in from the side. That's a regular basketball play, and Draymond made it in a way that was as low contact as possible. He was trying to do it, I think, to strip the ball. He knew that it was likely that there would be physical contact, but he was willing to accept that as a foul to stop the fast break. But he could have gone in and bodied him straight on if he was just looking to have an excessive contact or not make a basketball play. This was clearly a basketball play and not an excessive one in my mind.
We'll move on from this with pretty swiftness, but at the same point, the other thing I want to mention is that if the NBA did a better job of making a rule for fouling guys in transition, it would help this a lot. Because at this point, you just kind of have a benefit of doing that, of trying to stop a fast break, and a clarified rule would disincentivize it a little bit more and make it less likely for this sort of thing to happen.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, I think the breakaway sort of clear pass foul and then just the regular flow of the game, there has to be something in between. You know, there are these situations where you do have defenders back, but someone's making an intentional play to stop a fast break. Whether or not you want to extend some further penalty for that or change the foul rules, I think it'd be worth looking at because it really does sort of distract from the flow of the game. But right now it's legal, so guys do it.
Absolutely, and you can't blame them for doing so. I want to turn to players outside of the stars because they all had good games and we've talked about all of them at least to some degree. Of the non-four, who stood out to you?
I thought that Andre looked fresh. He definitely was aggressive on offense. His shots falling and his legs look like they had some springiness to them, which is always encouraging. The 3 days off probably had something to do with that. The offense, particularly the second unit, just flows a lot better when he's willing to take his shots and when he's hitting them. So I think that particularly in the first half, that was one of the big factors that helped accelerate the Warriors' momentum and pulling away from the Cavs. I also thought in the second unit that both JaVale and West did their jobs nicely. In the first quarter, JaVale got out and ran and really put some pressure on what is a weak defensive front line for the Cavs. He got out, got some alley-oops, really forced them to play defense down low, and they didn't really have an answer for it. So limited run, but again, something that it could be a point where the Warriors would have stumbled in the past, would have let a team back in, and instead I think they went on a 10-1 run during one of the stretches when JaVale was there. Same thing later in the game for West. When the offense stagnated, it was West who got it going with his passing, really looking for the Warriors cutting, moving, finding them, getting them out of that funk in the third quarter when Cleveland went on a bit of a run. So you combine those players, and I think that you have important answers for the second unit. It's really been the Achilles heel of this team, the way that they've let others back into the game. So finding consistency there and finding what the defined roles are going to be for each of the guys, I think is important for Kerr, particularly during this middle stretch of the season as he's really sort of still experimenting and trying to find the best combination of players.
Same players, but the other side of the ball, it was incredibly impressive that Channing Frye never got off because the Warriors outside of Draymond at center do not have great personnel to slow Channing Frye down. And he missed a couple of shots that he should have made. That happens. But broadly speaking, I think the Warriors did a good job on it.
Yeah, it's always a bit of an adventure when McGee goes to the three-point line to try to defend a shooter. And Kerr let him do that a few times before he freaked out and pulled him.
Well, did you see a moment I think was really interesting in one of those spots, and I don't know if it was just happenstance or if there's something more to it, that after Frye got a wide-open three on JaVale, the next possession, JaVale defended Kevin Love, which was super weird, But I was sitting there going, well, I guess to a certain degree that makes sense because they're not using Love in the action as much. It was intriguing, though I don't think it's the answer.
Yeah, I don't think having JaVale do anything defensively beyond about 5 feet from the basket is ever going to be a comfortable position for the Warriors. But obviously, the closer they can get him to the basket, the better. But it was a game where they were willing to try to make a trade-off. Could they get enough offense and enough disruption from McGee and then survive whatever was going to happen on the defensive end? Then the gamble worked here. And I think for short stretches against the right matchups, Kerr's going to go to that because he thinks that he can do it. But I thought that the extended minutes from West, where the team played well and the ball kept moving, there's probably more of a long-term answer for the second unit there. He's really kind of settled in and found a nice spot on this team, I think, in the last month. So it's good to see him keep that going against top competition like the Cavs.
I still don't love the new second and fourth quarter unit just because they lack a ton of natural scoring ability. It helps with Clay when they have Clay out there. But when Livingston and Iguodala are actively looking for their shots and comfortable hitting them, as Livingston was on Kyrie at moments of this game as well, because Kyrie's foul trouble meant that he was in at the beginning of the second quarter, it looks a lot better.
Yeah, the aggressive Livingston is a huge upgrade from the passive Livingston for the second unit. If you're going to move Draymond into that second unit, as Kerr has, you have someone who can force the issue a little bit more and sort of penetrate and try to do things there. But you're still relying upon someone who's going to have to be, facilitated by either the defense or the spacing of the court. But Livingston just dribbling down, turning around, pulling up and shooting, is as close as they're going to get to someone creating their own shot, even with Clay on the floor. So if he can do that consistently, I think that that's a huge upgrade for the second unit. And he seems totally comfortable with it. They give him the green light. He comes down in the last few games. He's had great success with it.
They've also done a nice job with that. The other side of that substitution pattern change is having Curry and Durant on the floor without Draymond at the end of the first and third quarters. An element that has worked really well there, and we saw this, I think you mentioned it earlier, is that, generally speaking, teams have switched over some of their personnel at that point. And that makes it even harder to defend the Warriors in transition, broken plays, everything like that. And we're seeing both of those players do well maximizing those opportunities, and they are presented more often in those last couple minutes of the first and third.
Yeah, and it played out exactly that way at the end of the first. You had the Cavs with a lineup that had Kyle Korver, Kevin Love, and Channing Frye on the floor at the same time. It doesn't matter who the other two people are. They were Shumpert and James in this case, but that's going to be a disastrous defensive lineup. So the idea that you're going to have the two sharpest points of the Warriors offense and Curry and Durant attacking a lineup that has three people who should be hidden on defense, there's really no answer for that. And the Warriors went on a 10-1 run during that period. They really exploited it. So I think that it really puts extra pressure on even the best and deepest rotations for Kerr to go that way. And I think that Draymond, it's good to get him out of the first quarter a little bit earlier. I think it'll help protect him from some foul trouble. It'll give the second unit a nice burst of energy and intensity that Draymond brings. So I'm liking the adjustment. I think that there's still some tweaks to be made, and I think that there should be some greater flexibility in the long run, that there's not going to be one magic rotation that's going to work in every situation. But I'm encouraged to see Kerr and his coaching staff try some different things.
They probably aren't going to use either of these alignments in the playoffs just because the structures get so different when players are going 40 minutes a night as opposed to 34, 35. And it's good to try out these different alignments, though, especially giving Curry and Durant more time, because whether or not they go to more of the Durant with second unit, they're going to be playing more together in the playoffs than they were earlier in the season.
Yeah, and if you're eight in the playoffs ends up being the starters plus Iguodala, West, and Livingston, let's say, you're still going to need to have a stretch where you have West in at center, or you have Draymond on the bench for whatever reason. And you need to know that you can be productive during those periods and that you can still have defensive intensity and make a difference. So it's great to see them experimenting with that now.
It would be nice to see a little bit of Pachulia with some mixed lineups. He plays almost exclusively with the starters. Every once in a while, he gets some minutes in the second quarter that are a little bit different, because if they go more to Draymond at center lineups in the playoffs, Pachulia's role is arguably going to change more significantly than anybody else's, and I'd like to see how he does there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because with Bogut, he just sat more. You weren't going to find more minutes for him. Bogut's minutes dropped down into the low teens, if I'm remembering correctly, in the playoffs, for the reason you said that Draymond was playing center more. But Zaza, I think, could be more flexible. He played Thompson well at times. He was more active and sort of getting in front of Thompson, keeping him off the glass. So against a team like the Cavs, there could be other ways that you can slot him in and make him useful. And you're right, I'm looking at the sort of breakdown of times here. He played essentially no minutes where he wasn't in with at least three or four of the starters. So there could be more flexibility there as the Warriors shorten their rotation to find different spots for him.
Does it feel weird to you that we're not going to see these teams play at all until June at the earliest?
Yeah, and it feels weird, too, that we're still a little bit away from the Spurs games that we haven't seen them since the first day of the season. So it's a bit of a scrambled schedule where you have the two biggest challengers, I think, to the Warriors clustered in a short period of time. So these Cavs games will be a faint memory by the time we get deep into the playoffs, hopefully get deep into the playoffs to maybe a rematch in June. And I think that now the attention will turn towards whether the Warriors can maintain the intensity and turn in these types of performances against some of the significant but maybe less intense rivalries. So there'll be the obvious game against OKC this week. There'll be a rematch against Houston. There'll be Memphis. And then we'll finally get some San Antonio games here towards the end of the season.
Two things. One, the Warriors don't play the Spurs again until March 11th, so about 2 months away, which is crazy long. And I believe the Warriors don't play the Jazz for even longer, which is another team I'm excited about because of the weird stuff with them this year and everything else. I could be wrong on that one, but I think I'm right. The second point, I forgot to make this earlier and I was a little bit mad at myself. We got a little bit of an inkling about how the Warriors could handle defensive rebounding in their last game, as much as I don't want to read too much into that Pistons contest because it was just weird, and the Warriors had that third quarter where they just knocked him out after KCP was already injured. Andre Drummond was awesome in that first quarter, was dominant, got a couple offensive rebounds, was able to establish position, and then was basically a non-factor in the rest of that game. And that might have provided a little bit of the team effort template that they used here.
Yeah, I think that even into the playoffs last year, there was this ebb and flow of rebounding performances where they would get beaten up on the boards and then they would refocus and start gang rebounding again. You'd have Thompson come down and work more. You'd have Curry focus more on rebounding. They would all just spend more time on it. And it feels like that we've reached another one of those situations where they've gotten beaten up a little bit and now that they're focusing on it again. So I don't know if anything has fundamentally changed in terms of how they're approaching it. I don't really detect that much on the court. But it just seems like it's more of an issue that they're aware of. They know that they need to get back and secure these rebounds before they start the break, before they take off down the court.
One kind of final point, though, of course, if you want to talk about more we can do, is that while they played excellently in this game, I do not think this was the best the Warriors can play. I think they can do a significantly better than this, which is scary to the rest of the league.
Yeah, you look at the first half. The first half may be sort of approaching.
That was close.
The peak performance. They had, I think, 26 assists and 4 turnovers, if I'm looking at the numbers correctly, for the first half.
Their offensive rating was in the high 150s in the first half.
Yeah, so it's pretty good. That'll win you most games. Defensively, you can sort of check the boxes. You had a dominant Draymond performance. You had Durant making a big difference. Curry and Thompson, both had some nice moments. But I agree. I think that the third quarter, they still had that stretch where they seemed to ease up and lose focus at the end of the quarter and let the Cavs back into the game. If you were going to find a place to nitpick on this, it would be there. And you'd focus on, okay, how do we bring in that second unit and keep the same intensity that we've had earlier in the game? But it was good to see the team kind of bounce back from that in the fourth quarter. It was all scrubs at that point. for the Cavs. Although, no, actually, I take that back. I think LeBron played.
Yeah, I don't think they waved the white flag until about 8 minutes left in the fourth, something like that.
Yeah, so I guess that there was, you know, at least a period of the fourth quarter that was still competitive. But Curry and Durant didn't play, and the Warriors still managed to sort of hold their own and then expand the lead once again. So I think it's nice for them to have a fourth quarter where they stabilize without Curry or Durant coming back in, and then they're able to push the lead again. That's positive reinforcement for the types of things they need to do.
One other small thing that was weird to me in this game is that the first time these teams played, DeAndre Liggins did a nice job. Thought he did played well on Steph and, you know, just overall had a solid game. Until the fourth quarter, he played about 4 minutes. They were trying Shumpert out there. I thought Shumpert, they both have similar flaws offensively, but I thought Liggins played better than Shumpert.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix of players for them. I mean, it's going to be relatively inconsistent, I think. They're going to have nights where they look good and nights where they don't. And I do think that this team misses JR. I know that he catches a lot of grief and for good reason in a lot of situations. But he's been one of the more effective Cavs defenders at just grabbing and holding the Warriors players and getting away with it. And there really wasn't that sort of physicality on defense tonight from the Cavs backcourt. You know, they were bumping a little bit, but there wasn't just the grab and drag down that we've seen in the finals last year and some on Christmas Day. So maybe the Warriors have adjusted a bit to help prevent that. But I think the Cavs were also just being less physical and trying. It wasn't the same aggressiveness that we've seen from them in the past.
Anything else you feel like should be a part of the story of this game?
I think that everybody's saying this wasn't a message, but I think it clearly was a message. As much as the Warriors may want to downplay it, you know, it's like LeBron's rivalry comment, you know, by saying it's not a rivalry, sort of underlining the fact that it is there. But I don't think the Warriors should overestimate the significance or importance of this. They do send the message that they can be a dominant team, but at the same time, it's just a regular season game, and there were extenuating circumstances for Cleveland that should be factored into it. So none of this is going to matter in June if these teams meet up again. What will matter is that the Warriors at least learned a few things, I think, that they can do to help gain an advantage against this Cavs team and really play their strengths against the Cavs' weaknesses. So this should be a learning experience like anything else, and they should try to build upon that and capitalize on it if these two teams meet again.
It's a good point. I realized during the postgame press conferences, something Draymond made a passing comment about beating and losing to the Cavs, that Cleveland is the only team in the Lakeup era that has both beaten the Warriors and lost to the Warriors in a playoff series. Because Houston played the Warriors twice, and they lost twice, and every other team they've only ever played once.
Yeah, the idea that the Warriors were coming into this game having lost four straight to the Cavs was a bit of a double take. You think about it, any team beating this sort of esteemed, amazing Warriors team four times in a row, you stop. That's a significant statistic, a significant idea. And the Warriors, I think, finally wrapped their heads around that and said, you know, we're not just going to roll out our regular game and beat this team. We have to bring something a little more spirited and dig down for something else. And we finally got that type of performance from them.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, always great to be on. Have a good night.
Thanks again to Adam Wardson for taking the time to come on. You can read him at the Fast Break blog, the San Jose Mercury News Warriors fan blog, and you can also follow him on Twitter and the account at GSW Fast Break. That's GSWFASTBREAK. Interesting game, great performance, especially in that first half. And I talked a little bit I asked Kevin Durant about how he felt about the Curry, Durant, kind of how those guys have played the ends of the first and third quarters together. I think I'm going to use that audio. It'll be on The Athletic for sure, but I also might use it in a future piece, depending on how these off days go for the Warriors, because they will have that Thursday, depending on how I want to handle that. But thought it was interesting. He seems very happy with that. And the Warriors will need more comfortability with those two guys together, because whatever they do in the playoffs, Adam and I talked about this a little bit, they will need Curry and Durant together. So excited to see how that goes. We'll have a podcast it'll probably be a preview podcast of the Thunder game tomorrow. Move on really quickly with this team, with this week especially, having the Oklahoma City game and then the rematch with the Rockets on Friday. So exciting in that way. Looking forward to another couple of fun games. And also, I'm covering the groundbreaking tomorrow for the Chase Center, so I might do something on that. Not entirely sure yet. I think it'll depend on if any news is made, but excited for the opportunity because I've never been to a groundbreaking of anything before, so we'll see how all that goes. Appreciate all the support for the podcast. I love doing this so much. You can support the show by leaving a rating, leaving a review on whatever the podcast player that you use is. You can also subscribe, download every episode. Really do appreciate it. Feedback, good, bad, indifferent. DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com. Danny LaRue on Twitter. I read everything that, unless I happen to lose it in the scope of everything, and I respond to what I can. I make no promises about response. I do make a promise about reading it, because if you take the time to write it, I'll take the time to read it. I really do appreciate it, and that's how we make the show better. You can also check out the other great work that the Locked On podcasts are doing, both NFL and with the Niners and Raiders, you know, doing what they're doing. I mean, we'll see what's going on with the Niners GM and coaching stuff by that by this point, a couple days or even next week, and the Raiders, everything that's going on with them right now. And also Locked On NBA, Locked On Fantasy Basketball, and all the other podcasts. A lot of great people are doing great work. Very excited to be a part of the family. So you can check those out as well. And we'll be back tomorrow with something likely on the Oklahoma City game, still working on exactly what and with who. But looking forward to it all the same. Take care and make it a great day.
With the holidays around the corner, now's your chance to save time and money at Safeway Stock Up Sale. Plus, earn 4x gas reward points on participating items. Look for tags on items like Honey Nut Cheerios. Select varieties are 4 for $8 with your club card. And select varieties of Betty Crocker Cake Mix, Brownie Mix, or Frosting are 10 for $10 with your club card. Maximum gas reward at participating Sunoco stations is 20 cents per gallon and $1 per gallon at Safeway stations in a single fill-up up to 25 gallons. Other restrictions, limitations, and exclusions apply. For complete details, go to Safeway.com.